That's a good question because I did leave that out, didn't I? It depends on, I mean, I think to some degree you can't help but put some of yourself into a book. But with this character I've written about, Harry Bosch, the first book I got published of his about him was actually the third one I wrote. I wrote two books that had never seen the light of day. They never got out of my desk drawer. And they were crime stories. And in those two books, I wrote about a character who was a lot like me. And so for the third time, and they were, I don't call them failures or anything, they were learning experiences. The second one was much better than the first. And I thought, well, if I write a third one, that's going to be even better. Maybe that will be the one to get published. And that's actually what happened. But I just had this sense that after writing two books where I was using myself as a baseline, I'm going to write about a character who's completely different from me. And so whenever I make a choice about him, I'll pick the opposite of me. So I created Harry Bosch, and I came from a big family. Harry was orphaned. I'd been married a long time. Harry can never get a relationship to work. You know, on every level, Harry questions or even fights against authority, and I'm usually somebody who goes along. You know, so in the very beginning of this series, in the first books, we are not alike at all. There's nothing of me and Harry other than one little secret thing that we're both left-handed. And that's, you know, nothing. But as I've tried to say here today a lot, I've gotten lucky. I somehow created this character that seems to connect with people, and that has sustained him over years. And so now I'm writing my 16th Harry Bosch book. So it's impossible to keep that different distance. And so somewhere along the middle of the series, we started having things more in common. The most important and obvious is we now have daughters the same age and so forth. So, you know, it depends on where you read the books. If you read the early books, I have nothing in common. There's nothing of me and him. In the later books, there's a lot of me and him, and I think there's some of him and me. It ends up being a two-way street. Well, there's two. Let me answer that in two ways. One is that process of having two books in a drawer. I think the initial reaction to that would be like, "Oh man, that's a shame. That must have taken you so long." But I enjoyed writing those books. They were fun. In fact, in many ways, writing those books was more fun than what I do now because my angle of growth was so great then because I was really improving from book to book, and learning, and being excited by what I learned. So the process of these books that no one ever read is just part of the journey to the one that people did read. In many ways, you could say my first book was all part of that. You know, I had to write those two to get my first book, and even though the stories are completely different to me, that was all one process that took about 6 years. And sometimes I tell that story, and people go like, they groan when they hear about 6 years. But it wasn't 6 years of drudgery or wasn't 6 years of frustration. None of that. It was a fun 6 years. I had another job. I was a newspaper reporter by day, and this was stuff I was doing at night, and I was getting stuff out of it almost every night, and it was fun. So I wouldn't trade it, you know. So I think the lesson from that is if you're going to be a writer, the fulfillment has to come inside and from what you do, not based on whether it gets published or whether you get paid for it or how many copies you sell. Obviously, all that is great to have, but that's not what it's about. And so if people go into this with that as their measuring stick, they could have years of frustration and unfulfillment. I didn't have that. I was happy. I know it sounds facetious to say this, but if I had never gotten published, I'd still probably be doing this in my room at night. and just putting the stuff in a drawer because it was fulfilling. You might find that hard to believe, but I truly believe it. The second part, which is just the practical answer of how to get published, there's no single way of doing it. To me, I've been published now since 1992. I still feel like I don't know anything about publishing. It's like it's this world in New York, and I'm not even sure how it works. So just imagine how naive I was back in 1992. And so all I know was the third time was a charm. The third book I wrote, remember I said I read literally thousands of books. I knew this book should get published. In a rightful world or a true world, this book measures up to other stuff that's on shelves at the stores. So I was confident in it. So the next step is how do you get it to those people in New York who you don't even know how that whole system operates. I read some how-to books, basically, that how to get published books, and they don't all say the same thing, but for the most part they say the way to go is through an agent. Find an agent, because if you're just sending blindly to publishers, the chances are it will end up in a pile and never be read. So I sent to agents. But wanting to hedge my bets, I sent a letter to one publisher directly saying, I've written this book, this is my background, this is what makes me a worthy candidate to be read. And then I sent 15 letters to agents, and most of the agents responded with different levels of interest. It's now been about 21 years, and the one I sent to the publishing house has never been answered. So I go with the idea that you should go with an agent. And that took a long time. That took almost a year. Because they all want to read it exclusively, so they would read my book, and I got a few rejections, and then I finally found an agent, or got heard from an agent who wanted to represent me, and then it moved very quickly. Within a couple months, he had sold it.
And I would just like to put a caveat to that, is that Lawrence Block's another very good writer who I've had the pleasure of knowing for a long time. And a lot of writers that are successful, they're just very gifted. They're very talented. It's not like someone kept asking Larry, like they wish they had the time to write. And he turned to me and he said, it's like if somebody could go to a Major League Baseball game and had the time to take batting practice, they could hit a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. Okay, we're not all cut out to be writers. And you have to have a level. You don't have to be a good writer to get published. You have to be a great writer. This man's a great writer. Okay, and that's so sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle of effort and sending things out and rejection and that kind of thing. But I will also tell you that if you're a very talented writer and you're persistent and you write a good story, it will find an audience.
Yeah, I would say that it's what would you call that system? An altruistic system?
Yeah.
That the worthy stuff rises to the top and is published. I think for the most part it does. There's always going to be examples of the guy who couldn't get published and then posthumously is published and wins the Pulitzer Prize or something. There's always examples of the opposite, but I would say for the most part, it's a system, a meritocracy or whatever you want to call it. If your writing has merit, it's gonna make it. It's gonna make it through. Now then, that means just getting published. It doesn't mean you're gonna be a bestseller and all that, because then you get into the area where you need more than talent and you need luck. I'll be the first to tell you I'm talented. I have a big ego. I know I can write a good story, but I have had tremendous serendipity and luck with things that have happened, the people who have surrounded me, and I needed that to happen. I was just talking about the agents. I got names out of a book. I didn't know these people, and I send out 15 letters to agents wanting, and realistically, at the point that you have a book that you want to get published, the first one who says, I want to be your agent, you go with them. Because you don't know if there'll be another one, and all you want to do is get published. And so I sent out these 15 things, and I got some people interested, and I got some rejections, and then the one who finally came through wanted to publish me, and that was an amazing bit of luck, because he was the guy who had a plan for me, as opposed to maybe the first person who read my book. If she hadn't rejected it and instead said, I want to represent you, I would have gone with her, and I might not be sitting here. I might have a different career. I might have a career that's already come and gone, but by fate or whatever reason, the right guy called me. I'm still with him. He still has a long-term plan for me, and that's something talent doesn't control. There's a lot of luck involved in that, and that's just one example. It's happened several times for me to be able to kind of jump through all the obstacles to get to where I am right now.
I think Jonathan Kellerman wrote 4 books that were not published before his first book was published.
I know very few people. I know a lot of writers, and I think they all have something in the drawer. The one I know who didn't, and he's a very well-received writer and a really good writer, is George Pelkonos. And he bucked the system in all ways. He wrote a book, his first book, and just sent the whole book to a publisher without going to an agent. And about a year later, they called him up and said, we want to publish this. And that's like that unique story I told. There's always one.
George Pelkonos is a great writer, by the way. Any other questions? Kyle.
Yeah, it is. He asked about the development of the bad guys, who are the counter to the good guys in a book. And they're very important, but they don't take as much, what would you call, care and preparation to create. Because with your protagonist, your hero, you want that character to connect with your reader. There's no sense in a reader continuing with your book if they're not connecting in some level, some empathic level, with your protagonist. So that takes a lot more care and effort and planning and all the things that go into character development. With the bad guy, you don't have to worry about whether they connect or not. You can try for that, but it's not a make or break thing. And so that what that does is give you a lot of freedom to go over the top. You can make them, as you say, sadistic as you want to be, as creepy as you want to be. As sympathetic as you want to be, there's just a wider parameter of what you can do with the bad guy. The other part is normally, and certainly in my books, the bad guy spends much less time on the page than your protagonist. Your protagonist is carrying the story. The protagonist is your storyteller. This is the person communicating to your reader, and that's normally not the case with your bad guy. I've written a few books where the bad guy narrates some of the book, but not the whole part. So it's just a lot easier, I think, when it comes to writing about the bad guys. The one last thing I would say about that is I'm also less interested in the bad guys. I mean, some people, some writers are really interested in writing books to explore what causes someone to act out in this totally unacceptable way in terms of committing crime and horrible crimes and so forth. That's a very valid study, because it happens in real life. Even in a novel that explores this is worthy and important. It's just not my thing. I'm not that interested in what makes the bad guys tick. I'm more interested in what makes the good guys tick, and this idea that what police detectives do. By virtue of their job, they go into darkness, human darkness every day. And that's a risk, a risky operation, a risky job, a risky life, that you're going to see the underside of humanity every day that you go to work. It's got to have some damage. It's got to do something. It's like physics. You throw a ball against the ball comes back, a basic tenet of physics. I think there's human physics, that if you go into darkness every day, darkness is going to get inside of you, and then you got to figure out how to keep yourself from falling, how to keep yourself safe, mentally safe and whole. And that to me is a much more interesting thing to explore than why this bad person decided to kill this other person. So I have aspects of that second question because it's required, but it's not my main focus.
Can we have time for a couple more? Young lady in first and then in the back. You're first in the front row here.
How do you stop some of the
The question is, how do you take a minor incident in a story and turn it into something that's a major incident in the story?
Well, the small details are really vitally important in the book in a couple different ways. The ones that are like hidden things that the reader should have seen. I've written a few books where people have complained to me that I couldn't have guessed it. You know, I couldn't have guessed who the bad guy was because you didn't put enough information in there. And I always say to them, yes, I did. I challenge you to reread the book, and then maybe sometimes I'll give them some locations in the book. But I always back up the endings of my book, I think, pretty well. But I also hide that stuff. And through rewriting, the details can become really important in terms of hiding things and so forth. And I often have had those people come back and say, yeah, you were right. I just missed it. It's all there. I see it now. And that's always a kind of a cool thing to have happen that kind of tells you that you did it the right way. In another regard, the little details are really important because they can humanize your story and humanize your character. Little details are about the day-to-day life, make the reader almost subconsciously nod their head as they're reading the book, and because they're getting it, they connect. That's how this must be real. This is how this real life is. You know, a little example I'll throw out offhand is on a crime scene in one of my books, how the detectives would warn each other. There was a turnstile for a train that you would pass through, but there was a killing on the train, so they did black powder for fingerprints on the turnstile, and all the detectives warned each other, don't go through the turnstile, you'll get it on your suit. And that's something realistic that would happen at a crime scene. It has nothing to do with the plot, it doesn't mean anything, but it's a little tiny, what I would call telling detail, a little detail that opens up this world of the detective and what the minutia of his life is like. And minutia can often grow into something big. It can grow into a big window of what the world is that looks on the world that you're trying to present.
There's another question over here.
Wait, can you start over? Yeah.
The question was, when Mr. Conlon writes his books, are there any gadgets that he's used that really stick out with him as part of the plot?
Well, I mean, they're all like real, it's kind of like color. It's like putting color on a painting. Gadgetry and so forth, if you find something that's really cool, it can be very useful. And you're also got to be aware that when you can turn on the TV at any hour of the day and come across some kind of cop show that's totally dependent on forensics and gadgetry, and you're kind of in a way competing with that, and it's hard, sometimes hard to come up with stuff that they haven't gotten to yet, because television and movies don't have the dimension of books. In books, you go inside someone's mind, you know what they're thinking, and that's the primary battleground of a book. That's where you hook readers and what this guy's thinking or what this woman is thinking. And you can't get that on TV. You know, it's only what you see and what you hear. And so therefore they move towards color. They move towards gadgetry and aha moments and all that kind of stuff. And so I always have to remind myself not to get carried away with some kind of new thing, because the chances are it's already been on 5 CSI episodes or something like that. So it's cool to have. It just can't be the coin of my realm. The coin of my realm is what's going on inside characters' heads.
Okay, how about one more question? Yes.
I have a kind of a sordid history of Hollywood. I've made a lot of deals, and so far only one movie has ever been based on my books. And it wasn't, it didn't turn out so well. They changed the story pretty dramatically. And so it gives you a very cautious feel about going down that road again. The other thing is I write series, and so I have characters returning And I have to be, I learned the lesson. The book I had made into a movie had Clint Eastwood in it, and he played my character from my books. And even though Clint Eastwood is an iconic character and certainly influential on me as I was growing up and becoming wanting to write be a writer, at the same time, seeing him as this character I built in my head and in my books was so, I can't think of the right word, disjointing. I don't want to say disturbing, but it was not what I expected, and it made it hard for me to ever write about that character again. And so subsequently, I actually killed the character from my book, so I because I could not write about him anymore. And so it's funny, when I tell that story, everyone laughs, and I don't mean it. I don't want Clint Eastwood mad at me. I'm not saying this. I'm not saying it as a joke. But you, like for example, Harry Bosch. I've been writing since 1989, 20 years. I have an image in my head that is rock solid of what he looks like and what he sounds like, and it's not any movie star. So if they decided to make a Harry Bosch movie, and I don't care if it was the most successful actor on the planet, if it was George Clooney, it would be a big hit movie, but it would be so different from what I expect, it could kill my ability to write about him. And so that kind of concerns me. So it doesn't make me, so I'm not really out there flogging my stuff in Hollywood. If it happens, it happens. I do love movies, but I'm happy just to write my books and not pursue that too strongly. What's that? Yeah, I mean, I wrote two books about him. His name's Terry McCaleb, and the book was, did I just ruin something for you? Yeah.
Bloodwork, yeah.
Yeah, that was a movie.
And for you young students, that's called integrity, what he just talked about.
Really? What was that?
About not wanting the Harry Bosch, just having it done for the sake of a hit movie.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't have any say. Like, I had a couple of my books early in my career optioned to have Harry Bosch in it, so I'm saying this now, 15 years later,
right.
But if they suddenly woke up and realized somewhere on a dusty shelf in the back room of Paramount they have a Harry Bosch book that they could make into a movie, I would not be able to stop it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay, well, Mr. Conlow will be around for another minute. I want to tell you that I've been around books for a long, long time. This man taught two of my classes this morning, had lunch with us, and was gracious enough to do this afternoon. And I'm telling you, the man does not need the publicity. Okay? So it was a very act of grace and graciousness for him to come and spend this day with us. So I hope you all appreciate it. Let's give him a round of applause for his generosity.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Everybody go out and buy Nine Dragons. That's it.